Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello, welcome to On the Sporting Couch, a psychological profile and a bit of a therapy session with some of our most loved sports stars. I'm Gary Bloom, a sports psychotherapist, and that means I work with elite sportsmen and women who are struggling or have struggled to come to terms with the pressures of being in the spotlight. Meet George Groves, one of our most successful boxers of the last decade. He held the WBA super middleweight title and previously British, European and Commonwealth belts at a similar weight. His most controversial fights, though, came against James DeGale and Carl Froch, and they defined his time in the ring. His career spanned 32 fights and included 28 wins. Welcome to On the Sporting Couch. Today, George Groves, who once told me, "I don't like people who celebrate mediocrity." George, what's wrong with mediocrity?
I appreciate people who strive to do something a little bit special, a little bit extraordinary. And I get a little bit frustrated when we celebrate mediocrity. I'm not that way inclined. I'm very competitive by nature. I think most people in sport who get to the highest level are supremely competitive. If it's something that is important to me, I can become very selfish. You know, it's about me succeeding. About me winning. If you're capable of more, don't celebrate. Don't celebrate before you get to the top of that mountain. And I feel like,
I tell you what, I've got a problem with it. Here we go. A lot of young people, and we've talked about this on another Sporting Couch show, a lot of young people find mediocrity, ordinariness, just so difficult to deal with. And it's often that curse of ordinariness that leads them to some pretty weird and wacky behaviour that you might see in schools or youth clubs or knife crime. And that's the bit I'm not quite sure I buy into what you're saying, George. It's those young people who want to be special but end up then going on the wrong side of the tracks. I appreciate you went on the right side of the tracks, but how do we help young people just be ordinary and mediocre? Because not everybody can be a world champion. Not everybody can be a Commonwealth, British and European champion.
Yes, no, definitely. As I say, it wouldn't if everyone was special, then what would be special about that? No, of course. But it's about giving kids in particular the opportunity to do good things and to excel in them, to take pride in them when they have done something well. You know, if there's no opportunities, then you usually take the easy route, which is the wrong route.
What drove you to the right route? Tell me about your early life and mum and dad, because they're very, very instrumental on making sure that you go down the right path.
From a very early age, I wanted to box. From 7 years old, I wanted to box. And I think I was too young to box. You can't really box until you're like 11 years old. So I did what a lot of people do, is ended up in sort of mixed martial arts. I did kickboxing and loved it. And there was probably a lot of periods where, as a kid, you want to come home from school, you might want to watch cartoons, you might want to go out with your friends, you might want to do this, you might want to do that. But my dad in particular was very much, no, you've got training tonight, you need to get to the gym. And he would take me, he would push me. And there was times where I suppose we didn't always get on, because he was, you know, he pushed me quite hard.
Looking back now, and remember, you're a dad yourself now. Do you think he pushed you too hard? Do you think he was too?
No. That, I mean, for a long time, I thought, you know, that was a bit too much, and I would have done it. But now, I think it was just the right amount. He got to a certain age, and he just let me get on with it. And by then, it was already instilled in me to work hard, to push for it. And nothing ever felt unachievable to me. I've always been that sort of character where if I put my mind to it, I'll get it done. You know, you can't do everything, but as long as you understand what you're trying to accomplish, and you want to, and you truly want to do it, you can and will do it.
You see, I find it fascinating that a 7-year-old boy, and admittedly, your dad's really into Nigel Benn and Frank Bruno, big fan of those boxers, British boxers. And I can understand where he's coming from, but why would you want to fight somebody at 7 years old? I just don't get that, I'm afraid, George, right now.
Yeah, well, I suppose that might just be down to the individual. Maybe that's down to my background, where you know, where I'm from. But I promise you, there'll be a lot of kids up and down the country at 7 years old that are desperate to be fighters.
But there's competitive, as in football and cricket and rugby, but a competitive fighter, I think, adds another dimension to that. And I'm really trying to dig down to why you want to fight somebody. And this is a real, you know, theme throughout your sporting life, George, that you've always wanted to be involved in competitive fighting.
It was always the competition, because what boxing and kickboxing and any sort of sport will, you take the emotion out of it, you know. Of course, you have the emotion of winning and losing, but there was never the emotion of actually wanting to hurt someone. I just loved the fact that it was one-on-one, me versus you, and there is a clear line between who won and lost, you know. I've never been involved in team sports where there's scapegoats, where you could have an exceptional game and still lose and still have that that feeling of not fulfilling whatever you set out to fulfill. Boxing, you know, it comes with so many more pressures and so many more difficult things to deal with, but at the same time, you bask in the glory yourself, which,
so it's like having control over this sporting occasion in a way that maybe a golfer or a tennis player would do. There's only one person to blame if you lose, and that's yourself.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, you've got once you rattle through the levels and you start getting to the highest level, you'll have a support network around you. Those people are extremely important. They are vital, but ultimately, the buck stops with you. That's something that I probably couldn't have coped with if that wasn't the case. I have to be accountable for myself, especially if I want to try and go on and do something great, then that'd be that. In boxing in particular, you know, you know your idols are Muhammad Ali, the greatest sportsman of, you know, in history, or, you know, that's the common thought process. So that is what you're striving for.
But interestingly enough, George, your hero is, as a young man, is a fictitious character. It's Rocky. And that interests me, you see. This is, Rocky is not a real boxer. It's not as though you looked up to a Muhammad Ali or a Nigel Benn or a Bruno. I'm sure you held those people in great esteem. But Rocky is the person that really ignites your career.
Yeah, definitely, definitely so. But it's the story. It's the story of, we you know, maybe it's particularly British, the British culture, or maybe it is worldwide, the idea of the underdog, the idea that he can go on and achieve. And it, you don't, you know, when I was watching the films back as a kid, you know, your favourite moments and your favourite films kind of change. You realise when you're an adult why Rocky 1 won an Oscar and Rocky 4 didn't, you know. So, but at the time, you know, you just want to see him beat the Russian, you know, when you're 7 years old.
And I wonder if the Rocky story creates the template for your boxing career. The idea is, I'm always going to paint myself in the position of the underdog.
Yeah, it's usually at times explained to me, you know, whether I'm aware of it or not. But it's for people to make you feel good when things are really tough. It's like, John, this is going to be all the more sweeter when you finally finally get there over the line, when you finally happen, because you haven't managed, you've got no favours, people haven't made it easy for you, you've had to work really hard for this, and you're going to enjoy it that much more. I've always been a bit bullish. I've always appreciated and liked the thought of doing it the hard way without purposely sort of going down that road.
But I would say this is an unconscious desire of yours, George. As we look at your career, which we're going to do in this programme, you paint yourself as the underdog, the guy with a bit of a chip on his shoulder, the one who's going to defeat all the odds and still get there.
I think trust. I think I had a lot of trust issues.
Did you find it hard to trust people?
I beat James Agar as an amateur, and I didn't get the call up that I felt I deserved. I didn't, you know, he still stayed ahead of me in the selection process, and then went on to win Olympic gold medal, which at the time was just terrible for me. You know, he'd back then, more so even than back now, that meant that his career is now set up. He has the best platform to go into the pros, and I had to okay, well, I'm the B side of this rivalry as such, and I'm going to have to carve out my own route. I'm going to have to work a bit harder now.
Tell me about your early career. When did you feel, George, that this could be something that could define your life, being a boxer? When did you first have that realization?
I mean, that was always the plan from the second I wanted to, you know, from the second I decided I wanted to box, I wanted to be a boxer. And that was, if anyone asked me, that was what it was going to be. If anyone, my mum and dad would tell people that, you know, I'd be 10 years old, 11 years old, I was going to be a boxer when he grows up. He loves Rocky, etc., etc. I started boxing at Dal Youth at 10, and then 11 years old, you start boxing in sort of national tournaments, and I just kept winning. I won everything. I was, it wasn't until I was 15 and I started travelling with the England squad, so England cadets they were called, under 16s, which go all around the world, and that's when I started getting beaks. I was fighting you know, a higher level of opposition, some mature kids and stuff like that. So
what was that like? Did you find that hard, the occasional defeat?
Yeah, I mean, I sobbed my eyes out the first time I lost. It was, I never thought I'd ever get beat. I'd already had it all planned out, even at that age, that it was, right, my Olympic cycle's going to come round. I'm going to be 20, I'll go to Olympics, I'll win that, I'll turn professional. You know, I'm not going to beat Mike Tyson's record of winning a world title at 20, but, you know, a couple of years' time, I'll be there. I was going to be the greatest of all time. I think when I started getting beat on the England circuit at 15, 16... I didn't lose many, you know. I only lost really at the major tournaments. I think I lost two times the first. So they're coming sort of seasons. The first season I only lost two. The second season I probably lost once, you know. But it was frustrating. So I'd win all the golds, go into the major tournaments. So it'd be like they would be the European Championships or the World Championships, and then you get beat. Sometimes a little bit unjustly. Sometimes where you're fighting a, you know, a Russian in Russia, you ain't going to get the decision. And you come home with your tiny violin, you're feeling sorry for yourself, but no one really cares. And ultimately, it doesn't really matter, because you need to focus on the end goal. It was always, for us, was always professional honours.
This is On The Sporting Couch on TalkSport with Samaritans. When life is tough, they're here to listen. Still to come on the programme, George talks about his disappointment of those big defeats in those big boxing matches. The thing that strikes me about your story is telling an 11-year-old boy, your mum and dad did that, and the 11-year-old believing it, that you're going to be a professional boxer, there's a lot of pressure on a young man.
No, I mean, it was me telling everyone else. It wasn't at all pressure. I was never nervous about calling home and saying I'd lost a fight or anything like that, or disappointing anyone. I only ever lost, I lost a couple of times in the UK fighting as an amateur.
How did you deal with defeat? Let's go down to those dark hours after a decision, maybe a points decision had gone against you. How did you deal with that defeat?
Never well.
Did you blame yourself?
Never well. Not always. Not always. Say I lost 10 times as an amateur, I think probably only blame myself 2 or 3 times. The rest of the time it was sometimes true, sometimes it might have just been a bit, it might have been even Stevens. I mean, you're only fighting over 3-4 rounds, so it's hard to always tell. But it's just you can't stand losing, like, especially when there's other, because you're always going away as a team. So if someone went on to win the gold and you didn't win the gold, you would be absolutely livid. It just made you work harder, to be honest.
Let's just pick up that theme. And what you said to me when we spoke on the phone preparing for this show was, I was stung by not going to the Beijing Olympics. Was that the lowest part of your career?
No. Amateur career, I was...
De Gael goes instead.
Yeah, so
De Gael wins gold. Come on, George, you must have been absolutely devastated.
In terms of the heartache, it was. You're frustrated, you're angry. But I don't know. I don't think I was sad, because it's a gradual process. So, you know, like you have 3 or 4 qualifying tournaments that you send fighters to. De Gael went to the first one, didn't qualify. De Gael went to the second one, didn't qualify. So, can I go to the third one? De Gael goes to the third one, doesn't qualify. It's like, well, please just let me go. De Gael goes to the fourth one. De Gael qualifies. You're like, okay. And these ain't an exceptional thing, this cycle, you know. So the Olympics before, we had one kid qualify. His name's Amir Khan, 17 years old. Wins a silver medal, you know, so that's an extraordinary thing. You know, 4 years later, I think out of 11 fighters, they had 7 or 8 qualify. James Gale qualifies at the final attempt. It's like, oh, great, he's going to the Olympics. I'm jealous. I'm angry, not because I'm not going, but because he is. I don't want him to do well. And when he wins gold medal, I'm thinking, oh, he's going to get paid so much money for this. Not because I want the money at that age, it's because I don't want him to have it. And maybe part of me is still the same, because, you know, you're not supposed to say this publicly. You're supposed to, you know, hand on your chest and be proud of your country and the rest of it. But it's not actually the country that you're fighting for. You're fighting for yourself at the Olympic Games, in boxing in particular. So it's a proud moment. You get to go on a lot of TV shows after. You'll be able to parade it around. You frame your vest. You do this, you do that. But the thing that makes you smile the most is when you get 2 extra 0s on your signing bonus for turning professional, because you got an Olympic gold medal. If you don't have that, then you fall by the wayside. Maybe not so much now, because we've had plenty of Olympic champions, but back then, that's what it equated to. That's the honesty. Like, that's the honesty I'm giving right now.
And thank you for being honest. Very few people would have been as honest as you have been here, George, about your motivation. So I'm going to flip it back to you over the net and saying, was it then about money?
At that stage, yeah. I mean, at my age now, of course, I'd love to have gone to the Olympics. I've been proud of that achievement. And many so then, but there are maybe 2 or 3 ways to measure success in boxing. Your accomplishments, the titles you may win. But if you can leave the sport with some money in the bank, That's a massive success ticked off. So that's very important. Very important for a while.
Okay. You talk about measuring mediocrity. Have you left the sport with enough money in your bank account?
Yeah. I have, yeah. I'm fortunate enough to be able to do that. I'm part of the, I'm not sure of the exact percentage, but I'd imagine it's just part of the 5 or 10% of fighters that do. Yeah, I'm okay.
Because you took the very unusual decision at one stage of your career to manage yourself, and very few boxers decide to go down that path. I think a boxing commentator said to me recently, George did not want other people's hands in his pocket. Is that a fair way of describing what was going on for you at the time?
Nothing to do with money. So I turned professional under the Haymaker promotional banner. So Haymaker was David Hay, the fighter, the face of it, but his partner was his trainer, Adam Booth. So when I turned professional, I signed a promotional, a manager and a trainer's agreement with Adam Booth. Essentially, Adam was my trainer, my manager and my promoter. I'm not even sure if that's legal now, you know, sort of for someone to have that much control over you. I'm definitely not in the States, but over here it works for some people it don't. Ultimately, at some point, everyone's going to have a massive fallout. So they would say that that Adam would say that he managed me impeccably. You know, I'd won a Commonwealth title after 9 fights. I won a British title after 12 fights. He then, under his management, I was ranked high enough with the IBF that I became a mandatory for their world title. So, many respects, yeah. But I also had to have a lot of hard fights for that. And I also did an exceptional job for Haymaker Promotions. I was chief support for a lot of their pay-per-view shows. I was a loyal soldier to them. You know, I was stuck with them when they lost their TV contract with Satanta, and I was in No Man's Land fighting ad hoc on different shows, sort of carving my way through, hoping for something to come off. You always have that resilience, especially at that age. I was still young, was still hungry. I knew that as long as I'm good enough, the opportunities will come.
So why did you want to manage yourself?
So after I was 10 weeks out from fighting Carl Froch, challenging for the world title. Carl Froch is riding probably the only real wave of his career where his popularity was sky high. And Adam didn't want to train me no more. He sent me a text saying, you know, we're not working together, our working relationship's over. So, you know, at that point, it's like, okay, great, I'll move on. I'll do it myself, because I was ready. Well, I knew at some point this relationship was going to end. Ideally, I didn't really want it to end 10 weeks before my first world title fight. But I was like, well, great, I'm not going to tread water. I'm not going to waste no more time. This is my chance to go on and do it. And at that point, I didn't know anyone else in the game, because you're in that bubble. So I'm with Adam Booth. And anyone I know is either associated with Adam Booth or total strangers to me. So this fella that I knew for so long, who I no longer trusted, just meant that I didn't trust anyone in the game. And the only person I trusted was myself. So I was going to make all decisions myself, and I was going to apply for my own manager's license.
And there's the trusting again. Even with 10 weeks to go, you can't find somebody you can trust to look after your interests, so you look after yourself. That is a theme that comes back time and time again, George, isn't it?
Yeah. No, definitely.
Did it? Do you think that decision in any way, shape or form affected the result of the Froch fight?
Yeah, no, definitely. I took control of everything. I told the guys what time to show up for training. I had to go out and secure new trainers. I called my old amateur coach, Mickey Delaney, and said, can I use the gym? He said, yeah, of course. So I still use the boxing gym in the morning, and I designed my own strength and conditioning coaches in sessions in the evening. I had enough faith and trust in myself to go out and get the job done. It was a performance, start to finish, in the build-up, every time. Everything that was said was methodically thought about, assessed, and delivered. I don't think that's sustainable for your entire life, but for that camp, for those 10 weeks, it had to be, and it was. I put in a fantastic performance. I couldn't get rid of Carl Froch that night. I did my utmost. With a trainer that I probably had more of a rapport with, that I'd spent more time with, could have gave me better instructions in the corner, and I probably would have listened more.
Do you class it as a mistake?
No, still the best of a bad situation. That fight, I've publicly said that it was wrong. The referee stopped the fight far too early. I'd punched Carl Froch from pillar to post for eight and a half rounds, and then he has one attack and doesn't really land, and the referee jumps in.
Definitely. It's interesting that we've talked about psychology and our preparation for this program today, George, and you say, you know, you're not quite sure about how psychology works, but in that occasion, in that fight, you made a real effort to try get inside Froch's head. How did you do it?
How do I get inside someone's head? Well, the easiest way to do it is to counterpunch. So if you're a counterpuncher, you wait, you let them lead, you make generalizations about them in the build-up, you go, right, I reckon he's sensitive to this and sensitive to that because he displays this characteristic, that characteristic. What do I know about him? When have I spent time with him? What have I seen? You might go through and look at some social media, see some interviews, like he says this, he says that. So at the first press conference, right, I try and keep my cards hidden. I'm not going to lay my cards out. I'm going to try and give you a bit and layer it. Whereas I felt he went all in. He was extremely excited because Adam Booth had called the promoter. And the promoter was very close. Eddie Hearn was very close to Carl Froch. Phoned him and said, any correlation, anything you need to know about this fight, I no longer work with George Groves. Go direct to George Groves. He full well told him that, knowing that he's going to tell Carl Froch that the day before the press conference, right? So I got up there. And we sit at the top table, and Carl Froch feels he hasn't received the accolades and the public love that he deserves for all his performances and where he's at, and he's the darling of British boxing. And he sits there and the first thing he says, "I am an international superstar." Now, in my world, that's hilarious. That's comedy gold. That is brilliant. I can't let that go, because I think it. I don't even think Beyonce would say that. What, international superstar? It didn't make any sense to me. The only time he boxed abroad was Andre Ward, and he got beat from pillar to post. So I thought, I can't let this go. And
so what did you say? What did you respond?
Repeat that. But it was affirmation of the level of arrogance that he had sort of put himself way up on that pedestal. If you're going to use a statement like that, your accomplishments are mediocre compared to that statement. Don't celebrate your mediocrity, Carl, because you're not an international superstar. In this era, who are the international superstars in boxing? There's a few and far between. Floyd Mayweather, Manny Pacquiao, that is it. You are not on that level.
But you were stopped on a points decision, which you made very clear. You dispute the decision. And then you have this rematch at Wembley. 80,000 people turn up. Biggest fight in boxing history in modern times on British soil. What was going through your mind for that rematch?
Fortunately, I had public opinion on my side. There was outrage at the stoppage. People were finally sort of on my side, for the performance I put in and more so the unjustly sort of robbery that I'd sort of suffered. So then it was just, right, how do I get back what is rightfully mine? I had the mentality of a world champion who just hadn't been crowned. That was the worst thing that I had, I feel. So I was like, I've done this, but it's just, I just haven't collected my rewards yet. But at this point, I want to totally eclipse, the first fight with the magnitude of the rematch.
What were the psychological pressures you were under going into Wembley for this rematch? Did you ever feel under pressure? Did you ever have any dark days? Did you have any doubts that you could beat Froch?
Absolutely no doubts. No doubts whatsoever. Completely confident, extremely confident now.
Uber confident. But you're knocked to the canvas with, quote, what the commentator said on that day, the best punch you will ever see in a British boxing ring.
This fight wasn't a Rocky story. This fight was the first time in my life, in my career, where it wasn't down to who wanted it most. Didn't matter how much I wanted to get off the canvas, I was knocked unconscious. I'd made a mistake. I dropped my left hand. I stepped to the left, knowing Carl Froch sets it up with his jab, big looping right hand. He can punch hard enough to knock you out. Best punch of his career, as sort of was said at the time as well. But it was the realization that a split second mistake can cost you a lifetime's work. That's what it felt at the time. A lifetime's work.
Did it cost you a lifetime's work?
No. At that stage, I'd lost the first fight, but it didn't feel like a loss. This one felt like a loss, and therefore I didn't have that perfect record. I couldn't rewrite history no more. I wasn't the king in Game of Thrones who takes over and then rewrites history. Carl Froch is rewriting history, and now I've got no voice. I've got no backing. How do I get back? Fortunately, I'm still one of the most commercially viable fighters in the UK. I still have the hunger and desire to get back what's mine. Why now? But come on, let's just get it back.
Just before we move on from that fight, what was your initial feelings? And I'm going to stress the word feelings. Of coming round after being knocked out by Froch in front of 80,000 people. Was it shame? Was it embarrassment? Was it disappointment? What did you feel?
Well, everything. Truly gutted. Gutted. I looked at the corner and I was like, I knew it was stopped because the referee had stopped it. And I was like, is it? And like, they're like, yeah, So I was like, oh, so I know I've been actually knocked out. And then his performance, I'm thinking, right, you've sold this fight and you now need to damage control. Make sure that your post-fight interview is on point. Don't be arrogant. Just tell people what they want to hear, because that's the only way you're going to be able to save your career right now. Be fine to let that sadness across. Try and give credit where credit's due.
You see, there's a logical George Groves. Very, very clear thinking. And you were a very, very clear thinking athlete. I'm trying to go to the level further down, George, at the disappointment, the darkness, about what you must be feeling about the defeat. How do you get over that? There'll be people listening to this radio show who have had crushing experiences in their lives, the equivalent of you being knocked out at Wembley Stadium in front of 80,000 people. They might have gone through a divorce, they might have gone through a bereavement, they might have gone through a job loss or something like that. How did you pick yourself up, quite literally, and say, I'm going to carry on, I'm going to go back and eventually win a world title?
I wasn't ready to throw in the towel then. It was a new experience, as I say, getting beat, because you hadn't been cheated, and it wasn't down to who wanted it most or with the who deserved it most. That they're not real notions of life. Sometimes it's just how it is. It wasn't I need to give up or surrender or even grieve. It was damage control. It was like, right, how do I come out of this with some lives intact so that I can come again? That night I get home. I think quite a lot of the family came back to my a little flat in Isleworth. We came back to mine. I think everyone was worried about me, because I remember thinking, why are so many people here?
What were they worried about?
I don't know.
Oh, come on, George. They're
worried about me. I don't know whether
they're... Your mental state or your physical state?
Maybe a bit of both. I mean, my mum, the women in particular, because they've expressed it in my family, always worried about the physical state. You know, I think that's your initial feeling. Would always be the, is he physically okay?
I'm more interested in the psychological damage. And a boxing commentator said to me when discussing you a couple of weeks ago, ask George if there was any PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, that went on after that fight, where you had flashbacks to being beaten, you had flashbacks to waking up in front of 80,000 people. What did it do to you psychologically? Do you still dream about it?
No, not at all. I hardly think about it. More recent than not, I'm talking about it again. I haven't watched a fight back since.
Why?
I don't like watching myself get beat. It's not a process I feel I need to go through. It's not. I don't need to to remind myself of that. I'm happy with going through life with something a little bit disgruntled in my belly. I feel like that's what gets you up in the morning sometimes. That's what makes me, as a person, push on to do something good, to do something different, to do something hopefully special. I finished boxing now and I'd like to go on to be great at something else. You know, I've realised that my time has come and gone now in boxing. I don't want it anymore. My circumstances have changed. My home life's changed. My desire's changed. But having that disgruntledness in my belly, like, still, that things haven't been perfect, well, it's not so bad. It's not so bad. I've learned a lot in my career through the highs and the lows, and I'm not too fussed about going back and watching that rematch where I got beat, because I'm frustrated about the mistakes.
In 2014 you said, I'm sick of boxing. What did you mean by that? I know, understand what the words mean. Why were you sick of boxing?
So 2014, I think, we're talking about after I got beat by Baddie Jack. So the way it sort of felt in my head was that, and I spoke to an intelligent chap, and he used this analogy with me, and he said, you think you've climbed the mountain, but you're not. You're 10 feet from the top. You haven't stamped your flag in the ground and said you've done it. You ain't a world champion. You've got 10 feet from becoming a world champion, but you ain't got to the top. You got no belts, so stop walking around feeling sorry for yourself, thinking, I've done it, but I haven't got the rewards for it. You might need to start again from the bottom, but you need to go and win that world title. And I feel like that I was in that state right the way up until the Badu Jack fight, and it just wasn't right. Totally wasn't right. The only time in my career that I went into a fight knowing that this ain't gonna go well, you know. I was in the bathtub at the Aria Hotel, and they had a lovely corner suite, and it had a big glass window, and you sort of sit in the bathtub and look out at the Vegas sky. And that is not what you should be doing, like 2 hours before a fight, 3 hours before a fight, sitting in a warm bath. It's gonna send you asleep. You've got to liven up.
On the Sporting Couch on Talk Sport with Samaritans, when life is tough, they're here to listen. Call free day or night, 365 days a year on the 116 123 or visit samaritans.org.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I need to do it. I'm good at physical fighting. You know, I'm not good at talking. As I say, I'm not the best conversationalist. So I left Vegas rock bottom, absolutely rock bottom, ready to walk away from the sport. So it was the first time in my life I was like, what am I going to do instead of boxing? Instead of what I'm going to do after boxing, I was going to have to sell my house, you know, because I couldn't afford the mortgage repayments. I didn't, you know, I've got no other skills, you know. At that point, I didn't really have any other interests, so I didn't know what I was going to do. I started drinking coffees. I thought I was going to open a coffee shop, you know. But then it never lasts long. It's almost like it's ingrained in you. It never lasts long. It feels like forever. But it's like 3 weeks before I start. I go on a couple of dog walks, go down to Chichester for the weekend, I think, with and the dogs, and then come back. So I start looking at new gyms now. I'm going to find a new trainer.
So how are you coping having properly retired last year and it is all over? Do you still get that hunger? Do you still have the problems that the psychologists would call transitioning out of the sport? Do you have the psychological pressures on you, George? Do you know where you want to go?
I don't think I will. You know, the wins felt just as good, but the stuff that went into it, the build up, just way outweighed the satisfaction of winning. So, like a fight in particular after winning the world title, so that it's all a come down from there. It's all downhill from there. Now it's about getting some defenses in, earning some money, maybe it was, you know, put some longevity into your achievements so that you're not just sort of a one-hit wonder. I beat Chris Eubank Jr. It was a massive fight. It was the biggest hit on pay-per-view outside of sort of Sky. So it was a big hit on ITV. Sold out the Manchester Arena. Good fight for the fans to watch. Dislocate my shoulder in the last round. So I didn't enjoy that win at all. I did a couple of poses in the ring after. I got my belt, went into the change room in agony, into an ambulance, to the hospital. I popped the shoulder back in, get back to the hotel. It's 4 a.m. and I'm arguing with the promoter not to pull me out the final, because he's going, the final's got to be in June, because he's done some pre-existing TV contract. Like, you're going to pull me? 20,000 people just watched me win the semi-final with one arm. Like, and you're going to pull me out the final? Yeah, but these TV deals, I'm going to have to... It felt like he was saying, I'm going to have to make a couple of calls. It's like, okay, mate, you know, this is my livelihood on the line. But anyway, it was a fight continually right up until the final went out there. So I always talk about risk reward. It's not risk reward this time. It's, you know, it's workload to reward just wasn't there for me anymore. So I was like, I'm happy to now leave boxing. Young enough, I hope to go and try and be very good at something else. Not exactly sure what that'll be, but I like the freedom. I like that there isn't that pressure to get back in the gym, to get the weight off, to stay in shape, to do this, to do that, to continually be battling for the next position, the next fight, trying to keep ahead of the curve, trying to be dynamic, trying to be creative. They were the fun side, but doing it now without having any boxing looming just means that I could really sort of indulge my creative side, which is I might try some stand-up comedy one day, you know.
That would be great. Do you see any parallels between being a boxer and up there in the ring and stand-up comedian who has to...
Yeah, I think so. I definitely think so. I mean, it's performance. Boxing's definitely a performance. If you want to succeed, there's a lot you can learn from the stand-ups who can carry themselves, who can communicate properly, who can have that confidence that in their body language, in their presence, in their voice, to really carry themselves well, which as a fighter you want to do to sell the fight as such, you know, because if you can't sell a fight, you're never going to earn any money. You're not going to get the opportunities that your talent might deserve. But also, it's a battle, you know, it's you versus someone else. So you want to put on that performance against them. You want them to ultimately fear you in the build-up.
You have bumped into a couple of psychologists before, and your quote to me was, "It's not for me."
Sorry about that.
It's all right.
No, you know, I'm...
You seem quite guarded at some level, actually, George, about going to the very depths of your despair, the depths of your feelings. There's always, to me, having met you today for the first time, a sort of bottom of the elevator ride. There's no way you're going to go further than that.
Yeah, well, I'm not a big sharer as such, you know. I genuinely like the idea of keeping some stuff personal. You know, we live in an age now where everyone has to put their life online. You know, I saw a quote the other day where, you know, 20 years ago, you wrote everything in a diary. If one person read it, you went mad. And now you put everything, you put your whole diary online, and if people don't like it, you get mad. So, I like to keep a couple of things mystique, a couple of things personal, and 9 times out of 10 it might be because I don't exactly know what I want to say, and because I want to deliver good work, so I haven't got to the depths of whatever it may be, and I kind of want to get there first.
You said you didn't really want to talk about the close relationships in your life, but you are married to an extraordinary woman, Sophie. Do you share other things you keep from her? Are there even one or two little things you keep back from her?
No, I feel like she's probably my therapist. That's probably why I never need to go too far. She's my childhood sweetheart. I've known her since we were 2 years old, which is fantastic for, you know, when you want to post a picture of us in playgroup together. We've been good friends pretty much our entire lives, and we've been together now over 10 years. We've been married 6 years. Yeah, she's a wonderful person. She was there before boxing became what it became. So she's the only person, I suppose, you know, who I trust in its entirety. Well, obviously, other family members I trust, but they they don't get the whole picture because they don't live and breathe it like we have to. So her opinion matters to me more than anyone else's.
George Groves, a man with trust issues, is that fair?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I encourage everyone else to be sceptical, you know. And maybe that is because I live in the world of boxing. You know, and sport in general is a business. You know, the average fan on the street, they watch it because they have passion for it, because they love it, because it's entertainment. But behind the scenes, it's the inner cogs of business that will be the formula for a lot of things in life. And I've got a lot of trust issues. It takes a lot for me to trust someone, especially when I'm speaking into a microphone. But I implore everyone else to have their guard up from time to time, you know, otherwise you might get knocked out in front of 80,000 people at Wembley.
How do you think boxing is going to change in the next 15 years?
I think it will thrive. I think we'll start to see a demise in the Ultimate Fighting, which is lots of people were saying 5-10 years ago that once it actually was gaining some momentum, it was going to take over boxing, wipe out boxing, but it never will. The fighters don't last as long. The game's too brutal. It just won't appeal enough to the every man. You know, you'll struggle to get the casual fans in. You'll have the ad hoc personality who can do that. But
do you think that's because today's generation do not want that brutality, or do you think they sort of crave that brutality of ultimate fighting? I think you, off the bat, you do
until you're exposed to it a bit, and then you're like, it's no good, you know. Boxing is ultimately, once you get past the fact that it's two men punch each other in the face, or now it could be two women punch each other in the face, which don't sit right with everyone. Once you get past that, you see the skill element and the gentlemanly conduct as such. There are, you know, strict rules. You know, there are certain targets. You can't hit people on the floor. You can't strangle them. You can't do it where that end up being, like, uncultured.
So we come to the end of the show. What does it mean to you when I say the words George Groves, he won a world title?
It means that I achieved my childhood dream, that it wasn't all for nothing.
You got a huge grin on your face. It's the biggest grin I've seen today.
I like to undersell it. Hopefully that's the best way to undersell it. It wasn't all for nothing, because at some point it could have been, and that would have been my mantra. That would have been put on my tombstone one day. I achieved my childhood dream. I can add my name to all them other champions out there that done it. Don't celebrate the mediocrity. Keep pushing, you get there, and you achieve your goals. And when you do, you can maybe smile as much as I can.
George Groves, many thanks for joining me on the Sporting Couch.
Thank you, thanks everybody.
You've been listening to On the Sporting Couch, a psychological profile of one of our most successful boxers of the last 10 years, super middleweight champion George Groves. I'm Gary Bloom, a sports psychotherapist and counsellor, trying to help people overcome difficult feelings they're having in their personal lives. If you've been affected by any of the issues in today's show, or just want to get in touch, please do so via my Twitter handle, @bloomers57, and there are some useful links about mental health on our page on the TalkSport website, talksport.com/sporting-couch. And if you want to listen to this show again or recommend it to someone else, please find it as a podcast, Google Acast On the Sporting Couch. I hope you've enjoyed today's programme. I'm Gary Bloom, sports psychotherapist, and remember, there's no such thing as good health without good mental health. Goodbye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.